Welcome to Brewing One Ear and Out the Other. Our guest on today's podcast is Dr. Cameron Seppa, venture capitalist, executive psychologist, and assistant clinical professor at UCSF. We had an opportunity to talk with Cameron on November 3rd about UCLA, his experience as the founding team member of Omada, and how he has been able to become an executive coach for successful leaders and athletes. So without further ado, here is our interview with Dr. Seppa.
Would you prefer to be called Dr. Seppa?
You can just call me Cameron. If you want to introduce me as such, that's fine, but I don't make anyone call me Doctor.
Okay. Great.
Sounds good. I think Nockin's brother's a doctor, and I think in his household, Nockin has to refer to
that's a good brother flex. I like that.
Hi, Dr. Seppa. Thanks for joining us on Brewing One Ear and Out the Other.
My pleasure.
Because this is a UCLA-themed podcast, one of the things we wanted to do was ask one of the questions that current applicants have to answer as part of the application. We think it will serve as a great introduction for our listeners. So the prompt is, describe an example of your leadership experience in which you have positively influenced others, helped resolve disputes, or contributed to group efforts over time.
Oh man, this takes me back to high school. I think part of the impetus for doing service obviously can be to, you know, get into a good college or graduate school. And I think there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. You know, you got to play the game, but I think sometimes the best efforts come out of work that is very intrinsically driven. So, you know, when I helped start my first company, I was the head of clinical innovation. So I was focused on a lot on like research and development, and kind of had like my slice of the pie, so to speak. But, you know, I always, you know, considered myself an owner of the company and acted like that and thought, okay, even outside of my scope of my role, what should I be doing to make this company better and make this a better place to work? And one of the interesting challenges that happens is when you especially are in a fast growing VC-backed startup is you hire rapidly. Like here's periods of time where you may need to hire 50, 100 people in a year. It's kind of a breathtaking pace and it can rapidly change the company culture. And as a psychologist, I was really interested in culture, which is how do you make it not just a great successful company, but a great place to work as well. And so one of the things that I did, which was totally outside of my job description, nobody asked me to do it. The CEO didn't ask me to do it, was to take efforts to actually measure and improve company culture. So I spent a lot of work and I wrote a whole series, if you're interested, called Your Company Culture is Who You Hire, Fire, and Promote, which is a behaviorist view of how do you build and reinforce specifically exemplary company culture. So I can talk more about that, but I think that's basically my answer to the prompt and the question is, you know, I think it's doing stuff that you really care about, even when no one's looking or no one's asking you to do it, because you just feel like it's the right thing to do. And I have a kind of a, maybe it's a little bit of an anti-American philosophy where, you know, like, yeah, in the end work is a paycheck, but unfortunately with how Americans work, we spend the overwhelming majority of our waking lives at work, probably in fact more than with our loved ones. So I think actually having a humane place to work where it's a really great culture is actually important, because that clearly affects us if we're working 8, 10, 12 hours a day. So I think it's paramount that we create environments and cultures that are healthy. And so that's why I kind of went out of my way to do that.
And that company, which we'll come to later, I think is Omada, and you guys grew from 6 to 300 employees during your time, and you really influenced the culture.
Yeah, it was just an amazing rapid growth that happened over the course of 5 years, and I think this is pretty standard with all companies, is when you scale that quickly, you know, you're just trying to get butts in seats. And a lot of roles are highly technical. It's very hard to hire for. It's a highly competitive job environment for technical jobs. And so it's hard to hire good, talented people. And so unfortunately, I think what happens inadvertently, it's not because, you know, people like hiring jerks. It's just that, you know, when you have to hire rapidly and like things are breaking and it's tantamount to just keeping the company alive, you often make compromises. And so it becomes very easy to rationalize, I think, when you're in a high growth company, the way that you hire and the culture that you had. I don't think there's a lot of places that are like purposely psychopathological and, yeah. You know, no one would say they want a bad culture. I think it's actually more of a neglect thing more than anything, where it's essentially, if you don't prioritize culture, it will inadvertently sort of fall apart. Because what happens is like one bad person gets hired, especially if they get hired in a management or leadership role, they end up hiring people like them. So that one becomes two, that two becomes four, that four becomes 16, and it rapidly spreads. And before you know it, your culture is very different and where it started. So I always say culture starts on the top, but it spreads downwards very rapidly.
That makes sense. So it sounds like you've got quite a lot of experience kind of navigating the culture, but we kind of want to bring it back to the beginning.
Sure.
And kind of how you got involved in this process. So after getting your undergraduate degree in psychology at Harvard, you worked as a consultant for a few years. And one of the things we're curious about is what made you decide to want to go to grad school for clinical psychology?
Yeah, just to clarify, I did my undergraduate degree at Harvard. I studied psychology and specifically focused on cognitive neuroscience. I actually spent my summers all throughout college working in consulting. So I worked for McKinsey in Dubai, and then I worked for a spin-out of McKinsey called Katzenbach Partners in New York City, which was later bought by Booz and Company. And those internships were phenomenal working experiences because I was 20, 21 years old. And, you know, it wasn't like one of those internships where they're just like having you make copies and fetch coffee and, you know, do some BS project that nobody really cares about. They treated me like any associate, in fact, that had finished or was completing business school. In fact, the time that I was at McKinsey, they didn't even take undergraduate interns in the US. And that's why I ended up in Dubai. So they just basically assumed I went to Harvard Business School. And they're like, great, like, you know what you're doing. Let's do these projects. So it was a fantastic learning experience because you're like 20 years old, you're on the other side of the world, and you're doing work that, you know, like a 30-year-old, quite frankly, should be doing. So it was a little bit sink or swim, obviously a little overwhelming, but that's the best way that you learn. And so it was an amazing, tremendous learning experience. But interestingly, what I learned was, you know, obviously I learned what consulting is in terms of, you know, the work that you do. I learned actually a lot more about what working life was like. And that was a way more valuable experience. You know, at 2021, you're in your college, you're kind of sheltered. Of course, you have exposure maybe to your parents and some relatives and friends, but you don't really have exposure other than maybe your professors to, you know, a lot of people in the real world. And when I was working there, not only did I have, you know, all the older folks, I was the youngest person at the company, in fact, probably at the firm worldwide at the time. So I was, you know, I had like 27, 30-year-old kind of MBA interns that were working with me. I had the staff who were in their 30s, sometimes 40s, and then the partners who were often older, you know, and I'd go to their houses sometimes when they had events, have dinners with them, meet their families, meet their wives, and you get a real picture of what it's like, essentially to project into your future and see if I continue down this path in life, what would my life look like, right? And you don't think about that at 20-year-old. You're like, I just want to, you know, finish my degree and get a good job. And so I'm not a deadbeat loser to society and I can make my parents proud, yeah. Which is understandable. I mean, that's like your life, you know, your life mission at 20, 21. But it was an interesting experience. So I'll tell you like a interesting anecdote without giving away too much personal information. At one of these firms, I distinctly remember I walked into a bathroom on a Monday morning, and one of the partners of the firm was actually also a Harvard alumni. And I was like, hey, how was your weekend? He was like, oh, it was great. I went to my 10-year college anniversary. And I was like, oh, cool. How was that? He was like, oh, it was fantastic. It was way better than the 5-year anniversary. And I was like, really? Why was that? And he's like, oh, you know, the 5-year anniversary is a giant, like, whose dick is bigger contest in terms of like, how successful have you been since you graduated from college? And he's like, people kind of chill out at the 10-year reunion. And I was like, oh, okay. I was a little taken aback by the comment. But you know, the funny thing that happened is as I was literally standing next to him in a urinal, I like was doing the math in my head. I was like, oh, 10-year reunion. So I was like, this guy is basically, well, you know, I was still in college at the time, but I was like, 10 years is plus 22. He's 32 years old. I was like, so he's basically where I would be at 32. And I looked over, this guy had a head full of gray hair, wow, slept 4 hours a night, and kind of looked like he was like 45. And although he was super successful, millionaire guy, you know, successfully was a partner at one of these consulting firms, I looked over and I was like, you know, if that's the pot at the end of the rainbow, I'm not sure that's really what I want for my life. Like this, you know, I mean, he's certainly financially successful, but in terms of his health, his well-being, and also his kind of outlook on life, which was this weirdly hyper-competitive view on you know, his classmates and his life, I was like, that doesn't really resonate with me and my value. Even at 20, and I don't even know if I fully really knew what my values were, but I knew what they were not. And I looked over and I was like, that's not it. So funnily, I mean, those are like little funny stories that I still remember to this day. But I remember those experiences and something was just like inside of me was like, that's not really the path that you are meant to take. And if you do, in fact, that's what you're going to end up like. And that just didn't sit well with me. And so interestingly, even though I had spent all my summers working in consulting and had kind of prepared for a business career, after some of those experiences, I was like, I'm never going to work in the business world again. Cause like, that's not who I am. It's not who I want to be. And, you know, and like, you know, when you're 22, you're kind of dramatic and idealistic. And so I was like, okay, well, what should I do with my life if I'm not going to go into the business world? And I was like, you know, my mom was a public health nurse. So I always cared about sort of healthcare. The only reason I think I did well in college, in fact, was I loved psychology. I probably would have read half the books for fun, and you know, got good grades as a result of that. And one of my values in the positive was I really wanted to do something that alleviated human suffering. Both, you know, in the extreme end of things, if you obviously look around the world and read the news, you see tremendous suffering in the world. But even locally, I was really surprised that at Harvard, and then even later at UCLA or any go to any public institution of higher learning, you see how much students suffer almost needlessly because you're in high stress environments. You know, you come from different family backgrounds. It's a strange hyper-competitive environment of its own, different than consulting, but you know, academia has its own pressures. And you see a lot of unhappy people. And to me, I didn't think there was a more higher value, higher leverage way of helping the world than actually helping people with their psychology, right? Because you know, some suffering is probably endemic and it's a natural part of the pain of living, but a lot of it is unnecessary, quite frankly, because it's not because it's students' fault. It's just because, you know, you're kind of thrown in a sink or swim environment and you don't have the coping resources to adapt. You're like 20, you're like not even literally fully grown, right? And so I thought there was a lot that could be done there, and that meant a lot to me. And so I ended up going to UCLA and pursuing a PhD in clinical psychology.
And was there anything specific about UCLA's program that stood out maybe from other clinical psychology programs for you?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I mean, the obvious one is UCLA is the number one clinical psychology program in the country. So it's hard to say no to that. It's a great program, right? Objectively speaking. So the reputation is phenomenal. The professors are world-class. I actually had an opportunity. I got into the PhD program at UPenn to work with Marty Seligman, who is the former president of the American Psychological Association and founded the field of positive psychology. That would have been a super cool opportunity. Cause he's like, you know, a legend in the field, literally coined the term learned helplessness as an explanation for why people get depressed and, founded positive psychology, as I said, but, you know, I'm a SoCal kid. I grew up in San Diego. I spent 4 years in the East Coast. There was a little bit of a longing for me to come back home. So that was part of it. The other part of it too was, you know, I spent my college years studying positive psychology, which is essentially the science of happiness and well-being. And when I was kind of going around to different graduate schools and talking and interviewing with various professors, you know, the field had a little bit of a mixed reputation because, you know, happiness sounds a little like flaky rah-rah, right? And, you know, these are like hard scientists. And so they're just kind of like, you know, I wish they're like, you know, obviously there's a merit in studying what makes people and groups and communities flourish, but you have to be rigorous about how you study it. And I took that to heart and I was like, yeah, they're absolutely right. And UCLA actually has a place called the Cousins Center for Psychoneuroimmunology, which is basically how emotions influence immune function. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to study happiness, let's do it in the most rigorous, hard science bio way possible, which is how does it influence your immune system? And so that's actually what I focused on at UCLA. And I knew going to UCLA, that would be the best place in the country to study that. So it was a combination of, beautiful weather, great ranking, good professors, and then the opportunity to study a cutting edge field, essentially.
And it seemed like you did a little bit of a psychological analysis when you were deciding about your own happiness, the weather, being with your family.
Can't go wrong with that. Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is, it's not paramount. You know, in fact, you know, growing up in San Diego, I had the opportunity to go to Stanford. I was fortunate for college, but I purposely went to Harvard because I was like, I should go outside of my comfort zone. I should experience a different culture on the East Coast. I should do something different. You can always go back home, you know, but I think unless you stretch outside your comfort zone, you know, you don't have the opportunity to really grow and expand. And so UCLA, it was like definitely coming home in a certain way, but it was still expanding in the sense of like studying immunology I hadn't done in college. I had done some like, you know, work on mind body medicine, but I was like, I'm going to essentially become a psychologist and an immunologist. And that's going to be tough. But it's going to be a great experience.
I was hoping you could talk a little bit about your experience at UCLA in the program. So you mentioned studying immunology. What were your experiences there and kind of how did that lead you onto the path of working into the private sector?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So I went to UCLA. I think I had like a vague notion of, part of the reason I picked clinical psychology was it's a very practical degree. It's kind of like actually doing an MD PhD program. You're trained as a clinician scientist. So half the folks end up going on to become research professors, just like the ones at UCLA who end up running a lab, you know, teaching and becoming, you know, important scholars who contribute to a field. The other folks go on and work as clinicians. You know, they work as psychologists in hospitals, medical centers, and private practices, helping diagnose and treat mental illness. So I thought, you know, either way, it's a very practical thing.
Cameron, tell us what it means to be an executive psychologist, kind of how it differs from a clinical psychologist and why you decided to go down that route.
I'm an executive psychologist, so I pretty much work with executives.
Yeah.
That's not true of most folks. Most folks, yeah, I don't know, work in like their various community centers or private practices and kind of see a variety of people, mostly focused on depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. So there's two key differentiations. One, the population that I work with are like very high functioning elite CEOs, VCs, and I actually work with professional athletes as well. So they're like the top 1% of society in terms of professional success. So that's very non-representative. So that's one thing. The other part of it is my practice is explicitly not non-pathologically focused. And what I mean by that is the reason most people come to me is actually not to treat a psychiatric disorder. I occasionally, of course, have folks that either have depression or anxiety or will develop it if something bad happens to their life or their business. But my practice is actually focused on health and performance optimization. So what I mean by that is like a lot of executives, you know, are super busy running their businesses. And, you know, it's just like trying to keep a ship from running aground. And so you're frantically just trying to keep that thing going. And in the process of doing so, there's not a lot of self-care that happens. So I do a lot of work with people in terms of health optimization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have, and that's actually a perfect application of my training. I train literally as a clinical health psychologist.
Yeah.
In a traditional context, what a health psychologist does, and this is what I was doing at the VA, is you work with people who have a chronic medical condition. Mm-hmm. So for instance, during my fellowship training, I actually ran a behavioral diabetes management program. So these were folks who already had type 2 diabetes, were really sick. So their A1C levels, which is a measure of your blood sugar, were in the double digits. That basically means you have severe diabetes. Some of my patients already had severe complications, like literally having their leg amputated. So these folks are very far along the disease spectrum, very sick, and they're essentially non-compliant with their treatment. So they weren't taking their medications. Their doctors were pissed off at them. Their endocrinologist, like, I give up, you fix them. And they would send them over to me as if like, that's an easy thing to fix. And as you can imagine, like 90%+ of those patients were severely depressed. So of course they're not taking care of themselves because you haven't treated their mental health needs. So we would triage them, make sure they get their mental health needs treated, whether it's depression, PTSD, or whatever they're dealing with, and then do intensive weekly behavioral counseling to help them literally take care of themselves and adhere to the recommendations that their doctors were giving them. And obviously do some of the lifestyle or behavioral interventions as well, because nutrition is critical to the management of diabetes. So that's a traditional example of how a health psychologist, I would say, would work. And I essentially now apply that to a higher functioning clientele where I work with, let's say, CEOs on their diet, their exercise, their sleep, their focus, and also their intimacy in terms of their relationships, because those are what I call the five foundational health behaviors. And my thesis is if you're taking care of those things, you're optimizing them to the highest extent possible, you're going to do a better job running your company or performing at the highest levels, whether it's in, you know, as a CEO or an athlete. What I do is a little bit different, but it takes the same evidence-based treatment approaches, which is essentially grounded in CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay. And ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. Both of them are essentially evidence-based behavioral treatments. And so the techniques are very grounded in science and research. It's just applied to a higher functioning population. Well, the other part of it besides the health optimization is actually performance optimization. So in the end, the focus of what I focus on is like, I don't measure success by alleviation of symptom reduction. Right. If someone's like, I came in and I was moderately depressed on the scale and now I've gotten you to mild or none, that's not success. What success to me is functioning. Like, are you functioning in a better way? And ultimately that comes down to performance. And so for me, it's like, it doesn't matter what you're dealing with. Part of it is obviously identifying the barriers to performance. If that is anxiety, then let's do an evidence-based exposure therapy to make sure that, you know, if you're a leader, whenever you're giving a public speech, that's not inhibiting your ability to speak articulately and push your mission and communicate your mission with great clarity and conviction, right? So that's the big part of it too, is identifying what is it that people want to achieve, what's the performance that matters to them in their particular context, and then using the best practices from the clinical world and the organizational worlds to help drive that forward. I think that's the key differentiator. And I also think that's important because as a result, it destigmatizes the whole thing where you do not have to have a problem to come with me. In fact, I would say like 80% of my clientele do not have a diagnosable DSM disorder at all. They just want to perform better. And so I think that's a really key differentiator, especially if you're working in the executive realm. Because the reality is, of course, this is all spectrum, right? Like what constitutes a pathology? You know, we have arbitrary cutoffs of like, you need 5 or more symptoms over the last 2 weeks to have depression. If you have 4, you technically don't meet the criteria, but you're obviously mildly, moderately kind of depressed and still may benefit from some maybe lighter intervention. So, if you think about it from this much more flexible spectrum-based model, the reality is we are all somewhere on a spectrum. And second, we constantly are shifting on that spectrum, depending on the ups and downs in life that we're dealing with. So I think a good executive psychologist recognizes that and works with people in their, you know, week-to-week lives to not only help them improve, but I think part of the functioning too is also to help people not decline, right? If you ever have experienced starting or running a company, it's incredibly stressful. And that wear and tear of chronic stress sometimes takes the place of years. And a lot of people essentially experience burnout, which is, you know, in a lot of professions, any helping profession, including the medical profession, experiences a lot of burnout. But it's especially true, I think, amongst startups founders. And so just like maintaining their health and well-being and their performance without getting burnt out is a key part of what I do as well.
And you mentioned to be highly effective, you have to have the experience, you have to learn. Now that you're an executive psychologist, you're talking to CEOs, you've been through the trenches yourself as an early founding team member at Omada and helped Omada grow. You mentioned some of that early on about writing about culture and the company grew from 6 to 300. You want to highlight a little bit more about kind of your experiences there?
Yeah, so this will come full circle now about never working in the business world again. So how did I end up back in the business world? Irony of ironies. So by the way, that's a good life lesson that I've learned is never say never, because you will probably humbly eat humble pie and eat your words somewhere down your life. So now I'm very reluctant to say never. I mean, I do think as you get older, you do know yourself a little bit better. You do have probably a more realistic vantage point on life. And so there probably will be some things that you're like, yeah, I'm probably not going to do that. But I would say if you're younger, you may want to check yourself a little bit. And that even when you feel, I would actually say, especially when you feel fanatical about something, right? We live in a very ideological time where you can affiliate yourself, whether it's with a political party, an environmental stance, a nutritional stance. You're like, oh, those other people are terrible. I would never do that. And maybe you're right. That's quite a possibility. I mean, you could certainly be an ideologue. And I'm not sure that's actually something to be proud of. But you know, if you move along in your life and you find evidence that contrasts with some of your previous hypotheses, I think the hallmark of a mature human being is that you change your mind and you're willing to admit it. And you don't put ego first, right? So literally my life's motto, and I always tell this to all of my clients, is that it's more important to be effective than it is to be right. And if you can follow that motto, you're going to have a much easier time in life and you're going to be tremendously more effective. So long story short, so how did I end up back in the business world? So I was working, my last year of my training was at the Chicago VA. I was doing my fellowship in behavioral medicine, in integrated care and behavioral medicine. It was actually a very cool model where I worked alongside primary care physicians. And whenever they noticed that something wrong with this, you know, patient's kind of looking down, you literally do what's called a warm handoff and walk them over to my office, which is next door, and say, Hey, talk to my fellow colleague doctor here, without using the word mental health, because there's a lot of stigma. And I talk to them and I triage them and, you know, assess what's going on. Instead of, you know, booking a mental health appointment a month out that half the people aren't going to go to anyway, we'd figure out what's going on the spot. And you do time limited interventions. Sometimes I only work with people for 4 weeks, but you know, that can be enough to make an impact. And in the process of doing so, I also was running this behavioral diabetes management program that I mentioned, getting really good results. So on average, I was getting patients' blood sugar levels down by 20 points. But I tell this story sometimes. I had this patient come to me after group one day and he's like, "Hey doc, I can't come back anymore." And I was like, "Why not? You're doing really well. You know, your blood sugar levels are down." And this is also in the context of group therapy. So he was really seen as a leader amongst the other veterans in the group. And he's like, "Well, doc, I have one car and I have five family members and I can't take it to the hospital every week." And when he said that, it just kind of broke my heart, because I was like, that's not a medical problem. That's a socioeconomic problem. And I can't treat that. Like, this guy literally doesn't have the transportation to come here. And then it kind of made me feel bad, because I was like, you know, why am I even asking this poor guy to come to a hospital every week? It's not even feasible. Like, am I part of the problem? Are we part of the problem and institutionally? And it made me realize, I was like, you know, mental health is not a hands-on profession, right? We can do the treatment just as we're doing now over, you know, telephone or through video just as effectively. And the research actually supports that. So I said, why aren't we using technology to bring treatment to patients that they can do anytime, any place, in the convenience of their own homes with just as much efficacy? And I just became obsessed with that idea. And I was like, that is the future of medicine. That's how medicine is going to be practiced in 10, 20 years. And I want to be a part of that. And that's what I want to make my career about. And what I realized, however, is that the best way to do that is through starting a company. And so I never wanted to start a company. In fact, I always half joke that I was a reluctant or accidental entrepreneur, in that, you know, a lot of people, like, they want to be, you know, like a hotshot consultant, banker, businessman, make lots of money. That was never you don't go into psychology for the money, quite frankly. But what I realized was, if you want to use technology to bring treatment to people, you know, then starting a technology company is the best way to do it. And so, you know, I totally ate my words and then moved out to Silicon Valley and joined the founding team of a company called Omada Health to do exactly that. We created digital behavioral medicine, which is essentially taking my specialty, digital behavioral medicine, and creating an online delivery vehicle for it. So I actually spent the early years of the company publishing research papers. And that also goes full circle. I never said I'd publish again, but it was important because I was like, you know, how do you know, how do you create a company that is based on science and is just as valid as an in-person treatment? You got to publish papers. So, and I was like, I did learn that skill set at UCLA, so I might as well use it. And so I reluctantly published more papers, but it, you know, it was important. Sometimes you do things even though you don't like them, but they are important. And I was the first person to actually publish the term digital therapeutics in a research paper and define the field as, you know, taking evidence-based behavioral therapies and delivering them in an online format that makes it accessible and scalable to millions of people. And that was the vision for the company. And that was the vision for what I wanted to do with my career. And that's how I ended up back in the business world in Silicon Valley and doing it. But I think that it was a much different and better experience the second time around. Because as opposed to, you know, being a consultant and just being a spreadsheet monkey and, you know, sending decks to people that most of the time they never implement, no offense to my consultant colleagues. You know, when you're starting a company, it was a mission-driven company. And we helped 250,000 people lose 2.5 million pounds and cut their rate of converting to diabetes and heart disease by 1/3 to 1/2. So it was huge public health impact and much more than I could have done if I was just still working in a hospital, you know, treating patients one-on-one or in group settings. So to me, the mission and the vision of the company was more than just a capitalistic endeavor. It was actually genuinely to help people. And I also, and that was part of my maturity too, is realizing that these are not mutually exclusive. Like, I made good money. The company is a $600 million company that's going to make its investors very wealthy. And it does good in the world. And so these things are not mutually exclusive. You can do well for yourself and your family and do good in the world. And I want people to know and understand that is a possibility. Now, of course, there are trade-offs. And there's always going to be compromises that you have to make personally and professionally. But I think if you know what your guiding light are and you keep yourself to a high bar, it is absolutely possible to do that in various capacities. And maybe through your main job, and maybe, you know, your main job is making money and then you volunteer on the side. Like, teaching for me is volunteering, right? I don't make money from doing that. I do it because I genuinely enjoy working with students and giving back, because I've had great teachers and supervisors like I was talking about. So there's many ways of skinning a cat and making your contribution to society. And there's so many more options than I think students realize. And, you know, part of the reason I'm on this podcast is to tell people that.
Thank you again. And as you mentioned, digital psychology and something that you notice, someone couldn't necessarily drive to the hospital and you want to expand the reach and the tools and access they had. Now you're a venture capitalist and it looks like you're funding companies in that space. Was that something you wanted to get more involved with a lot more companies and you saw as the next phase in your transition, or were there any thoughts?
So after Omada, I actually, after 5 years, and the company was in a pretty good place, was pretty stable. I left and started another company in the ketogenic nutrition space because I wanted to actually make it easier for people to do the right thing in terms of behavior change. Scaled that company, sold that company, and then got invited to become a executive in residence at Trinity Ventures and to essentially train as a venture capitalist. And for me, the impetus to do that was, again, it was actually very mission driven. I saw my career basically in three parts, and I was fortunate that I had this kind of vision early on, in that, as I was saying, when I was at UCLA, the only two options were you either become a clinician or you either become a professor, right? So what I realized was those are almost like two different parts of a spectrum. So you're either a clinician on the front lines delivering treatments to patients, right? If you take one step back, you're a research professor, just like the ones at UCLA, and they're developing the treatments, right? They're not delivering them, but they're like, let's figure out the new CBT or the new anxiety disorders treatment that's latest, cutting edge, and more effective, so that we can then hand it off to the clinicians on the front line and they can deliver it to patients, right? So it's a little bit more meta in terms of what clinical professors, clinical research professors, I should say, do. But I realized there's this whole third option, which is essentially you're creating the delivery vehicles for those treatments. And that's what we were doing at Omada. We didn't invent the diabetes prevention program. That was a, you know, pre-existing intervention that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2002. We digitized it, right? We made it much more easy to deliver. That was just as effective. And then I realized there's even a fourth, even more meta thing on the spectrum, which is when you become an investor, I can now invest in dozens of companies that improve the delivery of healthcare to people. So if I want to now help not just hundreds of thousands of people, but millions of people, actually the best way I can do that is as an investor. So that's how I ended up getting into doing the investing thing. And, you know, that's not to say that I won't, you know, continue down with entrepreneurship. You know, there may be another company left in me at some point if I feel so compelled by a mission. And that may be the case. But for now, I'm enjoying doing the investing because I can help lots of companies, you know, continue to have impact in disparate ways.
So kind of summarizing a lot of what you talked about today, we were hoping you could kind of give us some tips and tools that an average person can use from psychology or learnings from the field that you've experienced, and how a person, just a normal listener, can use some of the information you've talked about to improve their everyday life.
Yeah, if you could improve people's life with a rapid fire quick tip, I would be out of a job. That's a hard question. You know what, maybe the best thing to do is just say, first of all, the default book that I recommend to people is a book called The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris. You can buy it on Amazon. Russ is a fellow doc who teaches ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, which is the evidence-based therapeutic framework that I use in my practice. So if you want to learn more about ACT, that's a really good like guide for the public. He makes it really like simple and clear and you know, fun to read. And the fundamental thesis is that the reason that Americans are so unhappy is because they're obsessed with being happy. And the danger, of course, of doing so is that that's your expectation in life is, you know, the moment that you're not happy, now you're unhappy about being unhappy. So you have meta unhappiness basically, because now you feel like you're doing something wrong or there's something wrong with you, quite frankly. And even when you are happy, you're worried that it's going to go away, right? So this is like Sunday and you're like, shit, I got to go back to school or work the next day. So ACT kind of does not put happiness or even the reduction of negative emotions as the focus, but really it focuses on living a value-driven life, which to me is a superior way of living because, you know, if you pursue the things that are meaningful and important to you, the trick is you're probably more likely to be happy, but you also deal with it in the moments that are hard and you're not, because, you know, starting a family, starting a company, all these things are incredibly meaningful and rich, but they're not easy and there's going to be pain involved, as everyone knows. And so I think it's a much more functional way of living. So I would say, check that book out if you're interested in ACT, and then follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Sepah, DrSepah. I write a bunch of articles on Medium and LinkedIn. Happy to engage with folks, in a dynamic way.
Cool. And then, just our final two questions. What's your favorite UCLA memory, and who is your favorite Bruin?
Yeah, that's a great question. Favorite UCLA memory. You know, it's funny when I remember the first week that I went on campus, the head of our program was like, take a nice walk down Bruin Walk and enjoy those, you know, the steps and the beautiful grassy knolls this first week, because it's going to be the last time that you see it the rest of this year. Because he was like, this is going to be so intense that you are not going to have fun. And I was just like, damn, like that was a pretty intense moment. So I actually, being a little bit rebellious, you know, I definitely worked really hard that year, but I definitely took some time to just sit on that little grassy area, you know, that little grassy hill, and just kind of savor the experience of being there. You know, I, in a lot of ways, feel incredibly fortunate in my life that I'm like so overeducated and blessed to have the opportunities that I had. I come from a place in a world where I never thought that would be a possibility. And so just taking some time to just savor that and how beautiful that place is and how lucky I was to be there is honestly my favorite memory. So yeah, I still remember that to this day. And my favorite Bruin is John Wooden. You know, I think he has a lot of valuable lessons about leadership, about coaching, and about taking responsibility for yourself and for your and not letting your teammates down. That I think he's been both an incredibly successful, you know, person that has improved UCLA's legacy. But I think there's a lot of translatable lessons there as well.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Dr. Seppa, for joining us on Bruin One Ear and Out the Other. And before we let you go, feel free to give us a 30-second plug for one of the companies you're involved with, maybe the podcast you have or something else going on in your life that you'd like to talk about and let our listeners know about.
Yeah, I would just say the main thing is I love engaging with, you know, folks on social media. So I would say just follow me on social media and keep an open dialogue, you know.
And hopefully everything we talked about today didn't go Bruin one ear and out the other.